The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Bahati Mutisia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Teen Magazine. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Teen Vogue. The first article is titled, Inner City Bloom Brings Healing to Formerly Incarcerated Young People. This article was written by Emily Russell and was published November 30th, 2021. On an October afternoon, a cinder block room tucked in a Brooklyn industrial complex transformed into a therapy setting. In the space, a group of formerly incarcerated young men and women confronted their traumas and reclaimed their narratives under the guidance of Garmis Sena. I have the right to make choices about my life and how I live, Sena, a 27-year-old mental health professional, said as she instructed the group to ground their sneakers into the gray concrete floor, breathe deeply, and recite the mantra with her. In unison, they exhaled and repeated the statement, I have the right to make choices. Destroying past narratives, particularly harmful ones that can impact the inner city neighborhood this group comes from, is exactly what Sena intends for participants to gain from the Inner City Bloom Wellness Workshop, a 3-hour experience she designed in September of 2020 that employs art, nutritional guidance, and reflection exercises to address increasing mental health issues within Black and Brown communities. In New York, Black and Latino populations endured the highest rates of anxiety or depression among all racial groups during the COVID-19 pandemic, according to a New York State Health Foundation study. Black Americans also experienced COVID-19 deaths at a rate much higher than their white counterparts, data reported by the Centers for Disease Control reveals. Sena witnessed the devastation wrought by COVID-19, as well as concurrent incidents of police violence and racial justice reckonings that weighed heavily on the mental health of her community in the Bronx, which the U.S. Census Bureau reports is 43% Black. She wasn't just a passive bystander to the mental health issues fomenting in the community. Depressive thoughts and anxiety mounted within Sena herself as New York's stay-at-home order took hold. But Sena was primed to confront the darkness the pandemic was brewing over her and her neighbors. Freshly equipped with degrees in clinical mental health and counseling psychology, she knew exactly what she had to do to reframe the story. From that recognition, Inner City Bloom was born. Black and brown communities were hit the hardest, Sena said. But Inner City Bloom came to mind, an idea that despite my surroundings, despite my circumstances, I can still bloom. I can still have good mental health. Over the past 14 months, Sena has hosted her Inner City Bloom workshops in community centers, a church, a public gardens in Brooklyn, and the Bronx. But on the particular October afternoon mentioned above, in South Williamsburg, Pfizer's commercial complex, she guided a group aged 18 to 25 who are part of the nonprofit rehabilitation program Drive Change. They are all re-entering their communities after involvement with the criminal legal system. Early afternoon, light poured through the warehouse windows into the cohort huddled shoulder to shoulder over a gold bowl of candles. The group picked through a basket of fresh sage, eucalyptus, and rosemary, binding tiny bouquets together with yarn. A bunch of laughter erupted from one young man. This is actually fun, he said. Anna Sophia Robes This is actually fun, he said. Later in the afternoon, the tone shifted as the group parsed through trauma. Sena introduced Kintsugi, an ancient Japanese art of piecing broken pottery back together and emphasizing the cracks with gold. This is a symbolic representation of the last time you felt whole, Senna says, handing out pottery to the group. When it comes to trauma, we can feel broken, but we can find beauty in our situation, in our story, in our past. An ear-piercing shattered reverberated through the room. A participant smashed his bowl with the mallet Senna provided. He glued the pieces back together as a representation of healing. One woman in the group said that the activity was a way of breaking boundaries, breaking limits, and breaking the negatives. Senna discovered this justice-involved group on Instagram and felt compelled to usher Inner City Bloom's healing energy their way. In fact, she had designed the workshop with her secondhand experience with the criminal legal system in mind. Senna was only in junior high when her brother was charged with misdemeanors. One of the biggest traumas for me was seeing my brother get arrested, Senna said. My thoughts were constantly consumed with, why is my brother doing this? Is he going to be okay? Trauma stemming from interactions with the criminal legal system doesn't surprise Sophie Wheelock, a policy and research associate at New York State Health Foundation who studies mental health and COVID-19. Especially for people of color, it could lead to long-lasting PTSD or associated trauma with those experiences, Wheelock said. Coping with this painful personal experience while supporting her older brother through his mistakes spawned Senna's empathy for healing others in similar situations, like those at Drive Change. It changed the trajectory of my life. It influenced the career I went into. It influenced how I look at young adults who make choices in their lives, Senna said. Many individuals that have this trauma, they don't feel that they've had control or they've had a role to play in what's happened to them. I want individuals that have walked a certain path in life to understand that we can take agency. Hopefully, they leave the workshop understanding that these were the choices that I made, but for the rest of my life, they don't have to be the choices that define me. Priscilla Mota Willis, a senior director of Drive Change's fellowship program, who invited Inner City Bloom to work with the group, believes lending formerly incarcerated young adults a hand up requires the exact approach Senna spoke of, a deconstruction of the condemnatory narratives developed in their inner city environs and afflicted with the constant murder of Black bodies and a rise of violence amid a pandemic. How can we create a space where we start healing and be truthful with the effects those things are having in communities of color who are marginalized already, our young people who are system impacted, whether that means they've been locked up for jumping a turnstile or having done significant jail time? Mota Willis asked. Inner City Bloom answered this question for Mota Willis. It was, she said, a unique opportunity to allow the group to become the writers of their own story. Senna aspires to help even more young New Yorkers from neighborhoods overrepresented in the criminal legal system and disproportionately affected by COVID-19 begin rewriting their stories and reclaiming their mental health. She is currently applying for a vendor's license with the Department of Education to bring Inner City Bloom to New York's junior high and high schools. Eventually, she hopes to expand the program nationwide. A lot of people, they push down, and it's hard to have that sense of agency. Senna said, that's why Inner City Bloom is so important. That's why I'm so passionate and so determined of getting this out there. The next article is titled, The Financial Abuse Shown in Netflix Made is a Growing Problem Off-Screen. This article is written by Ashley Belanger and was published November 26, 2021. Financial abuse is violence. That's what Made, an on-track to become the most watched Netflix miniseries of all time, vividly showed over 10 episodes released last month effectively raising awareness for this misunderstood form of domestic violence. Netflix projected that within 4 weeks, more than 67 million people watched Maid's hero, Alex, struggle to break free from her partner, Sean, the financially controlling and emotionally abusive father of her daughter, Maddie. With many viewers who sympathized with Alex, some were moved to act. Maid author Stephanie Land tweeted, "I have heard from a few people that folks are donating to DV shelters in honor of Maid Netflix, and this is the most beautiful thing. Thank you all so much." Even Maid star Andie MacDowell, who plays Alex's unreliable mom, told Land that she had a friend inspired to make a donation after viewing. This sudden outpour of donations came at a most urgent moment. The financial abuse that Alex suffered, income barriers like when her abuser cut off her phone, prevents her from working, or takes away her transportation, was one of the most increased forms of pandemic-related domestic abuse reported, according to a representative from the National Domestic Violence Hotline. Reports show abusers nationwide going to new extremes to exert control by limiting Wi-Fi access, lying about pandemic risks, and intercepting stimulus checks. There are so many things that abusers come up with as ways to control you, Land tells Teen Vogue, and financial abuse is key to isolating victims. Common forms of financial abuse include taking money without permission, controlling bank accounts, running up debt, credit card fraud, hiding assets, and preventing someone from making money or money-related decisions. Surveys show nearly all domestic violence survivors experience financial abuse, and the top reason that survivors stay with abusers is because they cannot afford to leave. In Maid, we watch Alex dodge Sean's explosive outburst and malicious cutdowns while her friends and family deny the validity of her abuse and the direness of her finances. It's not just about financial control, but it's wearing this person down, Land says, as Alex discovers the only real solution to the financial abuse she experienced was a stable income source, which allowed her the freedom to access childcare, safe housing, transportation, and independence from her abuser. As the show portrayed, organizations meant to help survivors aren't always enough. In January, the Journal of Family Violence published results of a National Alliance for Safe Housing survey of 800 pandemic violence service providers. The authors identified guaranteed income as the most promising way the United States could have financially supported survivors through the pandemic's double whammy, a dramatic spike in domestic violence and a quick erosion of typical survivor safety nets. Attempting to support as many Americans as possible through the economic shock, the federal government provided stimulus checks as well as emergency funding to community domestic violence organizations through the CARES Act, but the Journal of Family Violence report showed that organizations still struggle to meet survivors' basic needs. For Reemsha, a domestic violence survivor of emotional, physical, and financial abuse, who requested her surname and location be concealed for her protection, she already had a restraining order against her abuser in place when the pandemic started. That didn't stop him from filing her and their children as dependents on his income taxes and then intercepting her stimulus checks from the Internal Revenue Service. Reemsha has been working with the nonprofit Safe Horizon to contest ongoing identity theft, the last bastion of her abuse. While she feels she's healing from the emotional and physical abuse, it's the financial abuse she still can't quite escape, because like most financial institutions, she says the IRS lacks protocols to support domestic violence survivors. Through the pandemic, as she served as primary caregiver for her special needs son, it's been particularly hard to lose out on emergency financial supports like the child tax credit, which was designed to reduce child poverty and serve as a monthly form of guaranteed income for all struggling families. I went through hell, Reemsha says. The person who put me through hell is enjoying the payments. Despite contesting the identity theft since 2019, if Reemsha can't resolve her stimulus check issue with the IRS by January 2022, she will miss the cutoff for distribution and will never meet her payments, and never see her payments. She's not optimistic, and she isn't the only survivor whose stimulus check got snatched. The national nonprofit organization Free From, based in Los Angeles, provided direct cash assistance in grants up to $250 to $7,200. Provided direct cash assistance in grants up to $250 to 7,200 survivors in every state and Puerto Rico through the pandemic. They survived more than 1,000 grantees on their COVID-19 related setback. They surveyed more than 1,000 grantees on their COVID-19 related setbacks and heard that stimulus check theft, fewer financial resources, and slowed court proceedings that delayed income from child support were all commonly experienced pandemic impacts that financially drained survivors. Health policy expert Naomi Zude was a vision to help all survivors financially recover from pandemic financial abuse. In May, she co-authored a bold policy proposal to abolish poverty through the New Schools Institute on Race and Political Economy. In a guaranteed income for the 21st century, it's outlined how the federal government could use a progressive tax code to increase taxes on the rich and guarantee income for everyone who earns less than the national median household income, between $50,000 for single adult households and $70,000 for two adult households. It's designed to lift everyone above the poverty line for what's estimated to be half the cost of similar policy proposals by directing funds only to the poorest households in America, including the one in four women-headed households who live in poverty. Under the policy, impoverished survivors would qualify for up to $12,500 in annual income and an additional $4,500 per child. By providing stable income, Zude believes the policy proposal shows how the U.S. could build a functioning safety net for domestic violence survivors, fortifying the fragile web of pre-existing services that the pandemic proved were inadequate to meet basic needs. And that safety net would be there for every American. Everyone would have access to assets, Zude said. Whether or not we're in a pandemic situation, everyone just has, like, a financial foundation that they can fall on. Zude says this foundation would cover basic necessities as needed, but could also provide funds that everyone who's poverty-stricken can use to build themselves up and to make moves in the world and to make choices and to live out their dreams. In MAID, Alex attempts to leave her abuser, but his financial abuse keeps her snared. At an especially dire point, she is symbolically shown at the bottom of a pit, her eyes devoid of light. By the end of the miniseries, she's worked her way out, methodically plotted her escape, and reached new heights in her life, literally climbing a mountain with her daughter Maddie. In fiction, as is reality, it takes Alex setting up stable income sources to adequately plan for the future and end her financial insecurity. That happy ending remains a fantasy for many survivors. The worst thing in the world is when you want to get out and you cannot get out because you don't have money. For survivors, for the most extreme forms of pandemic financial abuse, like Reemsha, getting out of that pit will require more than grit and extra made shifts. It will require systemic changes where the government agencies and financial institutions acknowledge the pervasiveness of financial abuse. Freeform reports the average financial abuse survivor loses more than $20,000 in income and accrues nearly $16,000 in coerced debt annually. The worst thing in the world is when you want to get out and you cannot get out because you don't have the money, Reemsha says, adding that she feels uncertain of any proposed guaranteed income disbursed through the tax code after her struggle with the IRS. Zude agrees with Reemsha that any guaranteed income disbursed by the IRS would only benefit the survivor if they file taxes on their own, but that once they do file as individuals, they would at least know that money was coming. The idea of some type of guaranteed income, obviously, is important and necessary and needed, says Blair Dorosh, Walther, Safe Horizon Program Manager for Economic Empowerment and Shelters. But it doesn't help if survivors don't actually get it. To better protect survivors, Dorosh Walther recommends, in part, establishing an advisory committee to consult with government agencies and create pathways to resolve common survivor issues. It's stressful, Reemsha says. I'm still scared what's going to happen in the future. The federal government has yet to seriously pursue enacting guaranteed income policy, but recently recognized the power of providing cash assistance. President Joseph Biden promised to allocate $5 billion through the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act to community organizations to provide cash assistance to survivors in need. Advocates view this as an important step towards protecting more survivors, funding effective intervention before finances become dire, and preventing abuse before it becomes deadly. Freeform is one of 9 organizations in a national group coordinated by the National Alliance of Safe Housing to provide flexible funding grants to survivors, fundraising close to $6 million, and providing grants to thousands of survivor households. The largest grant NASH was awarded so far was almost $6,000. NASH founder and co-author of the Journal of Family Violence report, Peg Haskilo, says this flexible funding initiative existed before the pandemic, but was expanded to help serve more survivors remotely through the pandemic. An unexpected result of scaling up the project was that Haskilo discovered that cash assistance helped many survivors skip the hurdle of finding shelter. When we understood the power of just giving survivors financial resources to be able to get themselves safe without having to go into shelter, that was a total game changer, she says, adding that when we evaluate the project, we found that not only did survivors have longer housing stability as a result of the project, but they saw reduced incidence of repeat abuse. Freeform discovered exactly how little money it takes to turn a survivor's life around. Their survey found, on average, survivors need $730 to stay safe. It's such an obvious thing to do, Haskilo said. Oh, right, give survivors money. But there has long been a stigma against any kind of cash assistance. The success of NASH's project could work to disprove the stigma, and Haskilo and Amy Durrance, director of Systems Change Initiatives at Freeform, say that some private funders are seeing the value of direct cash assistance. Zude believes there is one missing ingredient to generate the kind of momentum we're seeing around cash assistance and form an effective push for guaranteed income as a national policy response to the pandemic: political will. For now, there is more movement in starting guaranteed income programs at the local level, with encouraging PLOT programs attempting to combat poverty and in a handful of U.S. cities. Without broader systemic change, like guaranteed income, financially strained domestic violence survivors will continue to rely on cash-strapped organizations. Freeform, unfortunately, had to pause Safe Fund applications after the waitlist hit 3,000. And the National Alliance for Safe Housing has plans to launch an application next year that would streamline flexible funding requests and track funding sources so survivors wouldn't have to verify expenses. But first, they just need the funding to build that technology. As a survivor of financial and emotional abuse, Land's goal for MAID was to raise awareness of how hard single mothers work to escape poverty, and her next book, Class, about the American education system, will go one step further, showing her 5-year slog to get off government assistance. Through the Netflix adaptation, MAID also raised awareness of what financial abuse looks like and it began trending after the pandemic exposed how vicious and widespread the issue really is. When Reemsha logged into Netflix and saw Made trending, she couldn't believe so many people cared about a story that sounded so much like hers. She'd already read Land's book and considered it an accurate picture of financial abuse. "I was really happy when I saw it trending," Reemsha said. "I was like, yes, finally, people can understand." And the last article, vaccination status in schools is causing tension among students. This article is written by Fortessa Latifi and was published October 19th of 2021. Piper, a sophomore at Texas A&M, tested positive for COVID-19 on the third day of fall classes. 2 weeks later, the first COVID-related death of a Texas A&M student was reported. 20-year-old Christine Catherine Ahur had died from the virus. By the beginning of October, the university reported 4,263 positive COVID cases. But outside the dorm room where Piper isolated and the plaza where students protested, the university's COVID response, Piper says many of her peers continue on with life as though a deadly virus had not been ramping the country for almost 2 years. "People just want to live their normal lives," Piper said, "but none of this is normal." As schools reopen for the fall, many welcoming students back on campus fully in person for the first time since March 2020, different rules for campus and the campus cause confusion and distrust. Students at some schools are required to be vaccinated against COVID-19, while others at schools in the same state don't need to wear masks even if they're not vaccinated. In places where vaccines aren't required, students look around their classrooms and wonder, are the people they are learning next to vaccinated? If they're not, are they safe? Vaccination status has become a source of tension among students in classrooms across the country. In the walls of their high school, rumored vaccination status has taken on a life of its own, spreading through the walls alongside the usual high school gossip. Now, with the conversation of who's dating who and who's not friends with who anymore, there are more whispers. Who is and isn't vaccinated? Rachel says the main gossip in school this year is who has COVID and whether or not they're inoculated. Kelly noticed that the accusations of being unvaccinated is thrown on top of other disparagements. The idea of vaccination is being weaponized, so if you're not vaccinated, you're being vilified, and if you are, you're on this higher pedestal of selflessness, Kelly said. And it's like another punch to the throat, another insult, like, I bet they're not vaccinated. These names have been changed for the purpose of keeping their privacy. All right, we have now come to the end of today's program. Today's episode of Teen Magazine. Please be sure to listen next time. I'm Bahati Mutisia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Teen Magazines is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.